Namaskar, namaskar, namaskar. There's a website, perhaps some of you have heard of it. Can we turn this, the echo is a little soft. There's a website which you can visit sometimes. It's called the Church of Google.org. Churchofgoogle.org. And this is a website which argues that in fact we finally discovered who God is. That God, He knows everything. He sees everything. He is present everywhere. He can give you anything you want. Who do you think He is? Google. It's Google. There are very solid arguments for why Google is God. They have a set of 9 proofs as to why Google is God. Would anyone like to argue why Google is God? Any suggestions from the audience? Why do you think Google can be God? Someone speak up in favor of Google. Yes, in the back. It has all the things we need, what? Yeah. Right. Exactly. It means it has everything we might want to know is present in Google, right? You can make a search, it takes less than a moment. And you can get, if you want to do research, right, then you don't need anything more anymore, no books necessary. You've got Wikipedia, you've got so many different websites. The answer to anything practically is on our fingertips. I come from a little town in the United States called Boise, Idaho. If you haven't heard of this, don't feel bad, because most people in the United States have never heard of this place either. Tiny little place. But if I gave you the address of this location, you could go onto Google right now and you could actually see that place. Right? You could go to Google Earth, you could zoom in and see exactly the way my house is laid out and the way it is. Okay? So, very good argument for the existence of Google as God. Anything else? What's another good argument?
Google gives answers. God is always silent.
Ah, good point. Very good point. We pray to God every day, right? And maybe once in a lifetime we hear Him say something. And even then we're not sure if it's Him or it's our own mind going crazy. But with Google, it's instant, right? He always answers our prayer. You know, on this website, if you go to Church of Google, they have the same Google search field, but instead of the button saying search, it says pray, right? So you put something in and then you pray. And you will be given the answer immediately, right? He always gives us what we want. Excellent. Someone had a hand up there. Yes.
In that way, it is a world of virtual world.
Ah.
A world of virtual world.
Right.
You are getting everything what you desire.
Right. It's a virtual world. It's paradise. It's utopia. Even if something is not reality, it can become reality in Google. You don't need anything else to get the reality you exactly want. So instead of trying to go to heaven somewhere else, you can find heaven in Google.
Google only understands languages. Google doesn't understand emotion and feelings and what
not. Oh, you're on the other side, huh? Okay, so that's good. There's a cue, right? Argument for why Google is not God. Okay, there's a good one. It doesn't understand emotion. It doesn't understand feeling. I don't know, that's arguable. If you're feeling angry or something. Anyway, other arguments for why Google is not God, the opposite. Anyone want to speak in favor of a traditional God? No? Everyone's converted? This is all it takes. Now, faith in God has gone down so bad. This is all it takes. You all walked away today. Dr. Gupta converted me to Googleism. Google is not a person. What do you mean by that? Yeah, so I have a personal relationship with Google. My deepest inner thoughts and feelings, I put it up on Google, on my own blog. Everyone knows and it's searchable, all my emotions and thoughts and feelings. And he reacts according to what I want. Why do you say he's not a person?
Google is
visible. And so God should be invisible. Okay? Yes?
It's limited, so it cannot be a God.
Google is limited.
Maybe having some limitations.
I've never found the limitations of Google, have you?
Maybe from Google perspective, but beyond certain limits, it may be limited.
Okay,
there are always, it gives you answers that if there's any expanding mistake, when you find something beyond its capacity, it's unable to answer also.
No. It gives you the right suggestion. It says, did you mean? Google actually understands your emotions, your feelings. This is why when you type in the wrong spelling, it actually understands what your right intention is. Most of the time, right? Most of the time. Anyway, I'm joking. Joking aside, yes, one more here. Oh, God can create, Google cannot create. Okay, very good. Okay, so suppose we expanded the idea of Google to the internet, right? I think what these people mean is really the internet is God. Google in the broadest sense of the idea. Not limiting Google to a specific website, but Google in all its forms and manifestations. Google, Yahoo, and other such avatars of Google. Google is a complete sense of the term. So here we have, it sounds like a joke, right? God or Google. But these days, anything you might want is there. If you want to do research, you don't need books. As a professor, I spend so much of my time explaining to students why they should not do all the research for their papers, their essays, and examinations on Google. It takes a lot to convince them, because I tell them, well, you don't know what the source of that knowledge is. Right? You might get something which is not substantiable. Anyhow, I try to convince them to use books. It doesn't always work very well. The second, if you need a social life, right? These days Google has, or the internet has, so many possibilities. Right? You've got Facebook, MySpace. There's plenty of Indian websites also for the same purpose. Every 15 minutes you get an invitation. Such and such person wants you to join such and such group, right? And if you don't join, they might think you're not their friend. So you can have, you don't need to travel, you don't need to go visit anything. Anything else in life also, if you need to get married, you need entertainment, you need medical advice, right? All these things available on the internet today. Here's the problem. Here's the problem with Google as God. We live in the time of the information age. People say this is the information superhighway. Everything you might want is at your fingertips. No country in the world knows this better than India does. This may sound like a surprise, but India's presence on the World Wide Web is massive. It's huge. The Indian presence there, both in the United States and here, Indians are wired, they're connected. And India today is optimistic, right? It's in a mode of progress. Indians today have a sense of optimism. We're looking forward to the world as a place that we can conquer, a place that there is a spot for us in this world. No one can stop India anymore. You know, in countries like the United States, they used to look at India with a sense of pity, poor thing, backward country, and so on. They want to help India, do something generous for them. These days things have changed. People look at India with awe, with admiration at how fast it's moving, and even with a little bit of fear. Fear because they don't know what India's place is going to be in the world in the next 50, 60, 70 years. They're afraid that everything is going moving. The center of gravity in the world is shifting to Asia, economically speaking, politically speaking, in trade, in finance, in so many different ways. Nothing seems out of reach to us anymore. India's kind of made this huge leap, almost skipped the stage of industrialization and gone straight to the information age, where everyone is going from having no technology to being wired, right? Being connected. People have it with their mobiles, they can access the internet, their computers, their laptops. The old dial-up internet system where you have this sound that signals that you're connected, even that's becoming outdated. People are always online all the time. They say, you're always connected. You're never out of touch. Now think of it, I'm never out of touch. Think of that phrase, out of touch. Why am I never out of touch? I've got the mobile phone. And I can always be in touch. Ha, kaho, ha, bas aage, yin hai. Kaho, ha, bas aage. Yes, bas aate hai, bas aage. And this is the conversation that goes on 90% of the time. I'm just here, I'm right around the corner. I'll be right there. Yes, I'm right here. If you can see me, I'm waving. Right? We're always connected. No need to plan anything advanced. We can always just dial up anyone we want. Then we've got Facebook. We've got internet sites. We can be connected to people all over the world. We're always in touch. And yet, you see that more, as this technology progresses more and more and more, what people have found, that in fact, rather than being in touch, this world is becoming more and more touch deprived. You know, there's a psychological condition called touch deprivation. Every human being in this world needs a certain amount of touch. The sense of touch is very crucial. And it cannot be satisfied by touching, you know, steel and microphones and so forth. We need the touch of other human beings. A child craves touch. If you don't give a baby enough touch, you always keep it in this, stroller and pushchair and all these things, and carrier and so forth. They grow up touch deprived. It can be a very serious medical condition. But that need for touch never goes away in human beings. It stays throughout our life. We're always looking to be touched. And yet the more we are in touch, the more the opportunities to touch actually go away. Have you ever seen two people walking down the street? They're friends, and they decide to spend the evening together. But the minute they come together, what happens? One guy's mobile phone rings, and he starts talking to some friend somewhere else. In the meantime, the other guy next to him starts feeling lonely, insecure. So he pulls out his mobile phone and starts playing with it, and trying to figure out, who should I call? Right? And he calls too. And the two friends are walking down the street, supposedly spending time together, each talking to people elsewhere. spending their time planning for the next meeting, but they cannot yet enjoy the meeting they're in right now. Our lives constantly live in the future, constantly planning, constantly making arrangements for things. And yet more and more and more, socially we become deprived. We become out of touch. One of the biggest problems about the internet now, people, at least in the West, are becoming more and more worried about this, is the lack of privacy as a result of the internet. You can Google me and literally find out everything there is to know about my life. You can find out a person's medical history, you can find out their the amount of money they have, the properties they own, practically everything you want to know about a person. Your deepest thoughts and secrets, they're all there. Right? They're all present there. And this is the quandary of the whole thing. We know so much about everyone in this world, and yet we have relationships with so few. It used to be that privacy, someone's privacy was breached, it was broken. You entered someone's private world. Why? Because you had a relationship with them. You know someone very closely, then you enter their private world. You come into their home, they sit you down, you find out who they are, who they're married to, how many children they have, what they like, what they don't like. This is a product of relationship. Now, you have the facility to know all of that without any relationship. This is the crux of Google. This is the key of Google. Knowledge without commitment. Knowledge without commitment. This is the basis of what Google is all about. When I tell my students not to do research on the internet, why? Because here you have unlimited amounts of knowledge. But what you don't know about that knowledge is what? Its source. Right? Where it's coming from. What's the source of that knowledge? According to the Vedic perspective, knowing the source of knowledge is more important than the content. The source is more important than the content of knowledge. Why? Because if you have a trustworthy source, then you know the content is going to be fine. But just because the content is true doesn't mean that you can trust that knowledge. Let me give you an example. Have you ever been in a situation where someone knows something about you, or they have some knowledge more than you do, and they use it against you? They use it to manipulate you? For example, I might know something about Raj Mohan Guru. And it may actually be true. So I go to Krishna Chaitanya Guru and I say, you know Raj Mohan Guru yesterday, what he was saying about you? You know what he really thinks about you? And you know he was telling me this and this and this? And Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu starts to think, oh really? Raj Mohan is like that? And he tells me something, and then I go back to Raj Mohan. You know, I was just speaking to Krishna Chaitanya the other day. And everything I tell both of them may be 100% true. But I can use it to manipulate both of them and create division between them. Suppose I know something a little bit more about you, about a particular subject than you do. I can use it to make you look bad. I can use it to make fun of you, to break your self-esteem, to criticize. Knowledge is power, right? But who says that that power has to be used for something good? They say knowledge is power. But it doesn't have to be good power. Right? There are plenty of knowledgeable people in this world who have used their knowledge, their information, for horrible things, to do terrible things. Some of the world's greatest evil people, terrorists, people, dictators, and so forth, have been very learned. They've used their knowledge. They have so much knowledge. They're full of information, and they use that power for negative purpose. So just because you have knowledge, just because you have information, doesn't mean anything. It doesn't make you good. It doesn't make you learned. Knowledge can be a problem if the content It's the place, the source of it, the place it's coming from. The motivation of the person who has it, if that's not clear. In the opposite situation, think of a situation where someone doesn't know too much. For example, a mother. A mother may not know everything in this world. But when she tells you something, you know you can trust it. You know that whatever she's telling you is coming from a good place. And therefore that knowledge is going to be useful to you. Suppose you're doing something. I remember the first time I did a public speaking engagement. I was talking about Indian philosophy and religion to a high school class in the United States. I was maybe 13 years old. I was nervous like anything. Like my legs were shaking, my hands were shaking, my voice was shaking. I was standing there holding on to the podium, trying to get through my speech. At the end of it, you know what my mother said? "Wonderful. You did an excellent job. That was terrific. You're a natural born speaker." Now looking back, I know I did a terrible job. I know it was not any good. Was she lying? What was the content of her knowledge? What she told me, was it true, was it false? It makes no difference, right? Because where it was coming from, the source was clean. Her purpose was to encourage me that if I tell the child this, then one day he will be able to do a good job. He will be able to speak with confidence. Right? It was for my personal growth. So this is why the Vedas say content of knowledge is not as important as the source. If the source is right, you can be sure of the content. Even if you don't have all the content in the world. You don't need all the content in the world. You don't need all that information. What you need to know is that it's coming from the right source. It's coming from the right place. This is why the Srimad Bhagavatam, right, it has a very amazing definition of knowledge. That definition goes like this. Vedyam vāsaramatravastu shivadam tāpat trayon mūlanam. Knowledge, this is Śrīla Prabhupāda's translation, beautiful. He says, knowledge is reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. Now think about this for a minute. Knowledge is reality distinguished from illusion for the welfare of all. There's two points here, two parts. The first part is reality distinguished from illusion. What's that? Separating fact from fiction. This is real, this is not real. This is true, this is false. This is obvious. Right? We say, okay, yeah, this is what knowledge is. I agree. Separating fact from fiction. But that's not enough. What's the second part? For the welfare of all. What's the motivation behind that knowledge? What are you going to use that knowledge for? Because if that information is not for the purpose of benefiting others, then it might be information, but it's not knowledge. It's not what knowledge actually is. More and more people in the world are realizing this fact. Scientists, philosophers, technologists are realizing. The attitude used to be, right, people used to think that I can discover whatever I want to. I'm a scientist. And I do my research and I discover things. I invent things. And then once I discover them, I invent them. It's true, right? I've discovered the truth. And then it's thrown out into the world, that new invention. Maybe it's the car, maybe it's the computer, maybe it's the internet. What happens to it is not my responsibility. I'm doing pure science. Is it good? Is it bad? Is it beneficial for people? Will it be harmful? That's not my question, right? Let the religionists, let the ethicists, let the philosophers debate that question. My department is pure science. That's all I do. I'm just for the pursuit of knowledge. No, that doesn't work. With knowledge comes responsibility. It's not going to be knowledge if you're not asking the question, what's the value of it? Who's going to use it? Who's going to benefit from it? And we've learned this lesson the hard way. We've learned it the hard way.
You know, Einstein, he was one of the greatest scientists of the world. He discovered this formula, E equals mc squared. That in a tiny particle of matter, you can find an unlimited amount of energy. So many wonderful things came from that discovery, that idea. But you know what also came from that? What also arose from that idea, that concept? Anyone know? Explosive. The atomic bomb. And sorry, I need a different slide. Towards the end of his life, he said, you know what he said? Here it is. Anyway, what's wrong? Oh, here it is. Okay. He says, I made one great mistake in my life. This is a letter he wrote to his son 3 months before he died. He was revealing his heart. And he said, I made one great mistake in my life. When I signed the letter to President Roosevelt, who was the President of the United States at that time, recommending that atom bombs be made. The war was going on. He was worried that Germany would discover the bomb first. So his intentions weren't bad. But nevertheless, he regretted that decision for his whole life. Because the horror that came from it, he realized, knowledge is not enough. We have to ask, how is it going to be used? And this is why he also said, that science can tell us how things are, but not how they should be. How things are, but not how they should be. That question it cannot answer. This is why more and more scientists now are willing to sit at the same table as theologians, as philosophers, as religious people, and say, look, we need to work together. We can discover things, but we need to know how to use that. And there's so many things that we have so many lessons we've learned. Global warming, military technology, genetic engineering, nuclear physics. More and more we're learning it's not enough just to know things. Knowledge has to be for the purpose of transformation, not just for information. Information is not enough. Who is it changing? What is it being used for? That's the question. Point number one, okay? Yes, there's plenty of information on Google. But the question of how that information should be deployed, how it should be used, that's the question that needs God for the answer. That we need God to answer. Okay, but forget knowledge. Most people, when they go to Google, they're not looking for knowledge at all, you know? They're not looking for information at all. Do you know the top 5 searches in Google? In the last year, 2009, so far. The top 5 searches in Google, what people are actually looking for? The first one? Michael Jackson. Okay. That's the first thing. But beyond that, after everything after that, Facebook, Twitter, Twenty, this is a Spanish networking site. Another networking site, a Turkish networking site, I don't even remember the name. Every single one of the top searches on Google is people looking for what? Relationship. That's what they're after. It's not information. We're very proud of the information present on Google. But that's not what people are interested in. What they're looking for, all the searches, they're looking for information. Do you know that the vast majority of the internet, what it is? Pornography. The vast majority is pornography. Pictures of naked women and men. People are lonely. They don't have anyone next to them. They don't have relationships with people. They're looking for relationships. Where can I find this relationship? Where can I find some satisfaction? Where can I actually get some touch? This is what people are after. And this is exactly what Google cannot provide. This is exactly what's absent. The more we find ourselves in Google, the more we go distant. Compare Google with God. Right? Compare the two. And try to think of the nature of the relationship you find. I've got one slide here. Sorry. This lecture is a bit spontaneous, so I'm a little out of order in my slides. But here you go. Everything on Google is ephemeral. Ephemeral means always changing, moving like this. I had a friend who spent half his life on Facebook. You know what happened one day? Facebook deleted his account because he was using it too much. That guy literally had a mental breakdown. Everything he was connected to in his life, I'm not joking, everything he was connected to in his life was gone. His list of friends, the people he knew, the places he used to hang out with, the people he used to keep up with, the relationships he had, it was all lost with the push of one button by some guy operating Facebook. His whole life was finished. It's ephemeral. It's like that. You find something on a website. You cite it in your research paper. Tomorrow your professor goes to look at it. It's not there anymore. Or they've changed it. They've decided something new is important. It's ephemeral. This definition of God, eternal. Stop. Always stable. Always there. God hasn't changed in at least the last 5,000 years. Google is always in flux. He's always changing. You can never depend on Google. God, on the other hand, is stable. He's been there. He's been there before we had technology, before we had cars, before we had the internet. He says in Srimad Bhagavatam, Aham evasam evasam. In the beginning, before there was anything, I was there. Sadeva somyam iramantra asi, the Upanishad says. In the beginning, there was only stuff. God was there. How long has Google been there for us? Google is public. This is one of the biggest problems about Google, is its publicity. It's its public nature. I've already mentioned it. This is one of the greatest dangers of Twitter. How many of you know, do Twitter? Is Twitter popular in India? Not popular, is it? Catching up. Twitter is like the ultimate. Right? Little bites of information about meaningless things in your life. You know the biggest problem that's causing them? People are becoming greatly worried because it's a security issue. If someone wants to stalk you, if they want to know where your son or daughter is, where your friend is at, where your girlfriend is, where your wife is, or your child is, or your husband is, they know exactly. They can track their movements like anything. And this is being used more and more for purposes of crime. The publicity of Twitter is a problem. God, on the other hand, is something that we can hold completely inside. He's there, Krishna says. Ishvara sarva bhutanam hiddeshe arjuna tishtati. I'm there in the heart of every living entity. Bhramayan sarva bhutanam yantra rudhani maya. And from the inside, I'm directing things. I'm guiding the activities of all living things. If we want a private relationship, he's 100% private. Google is impersonal. I think someone mentioned this earlier. Google is impersonal. What does this mean? It means anyone can put anything there with no sense of responsibility. There's no faith attached to anything. It used to be that if you wanted to say something to people, if you wanted to be heard, you wanted a platform for speaking, you would go to the village square. You would go to a place, a central place. In London, in Hyde Park, they have a corner. It's called Speaker's Corner. That was a place where someone would stand, right? And they would announce their views to the world. What does that mean? That you're taking responsibility for your views. Like, you're standing up there and you're making your views heard. So that if someone wants, they can shoot you for that, right? You take that risk for it. That I'm responsible for what I say. People might love me for it, they might hate me for it. That's what you call personhood, personality. There's a face attached to everything. Okay, then we have the phone. The face is gone now. At least you still have the voice, right? A mother can hear your voice and she knows you're not doing well today, right? Something's wrong. What is it? Now, no face, no voice. You can create your own identity on the internet. Be someone who you're completely not. Create a whole virtual world. Despite the fact that it's called Facebook, it's completely faceless. There's no face. And anyone can put up anything on the internet. And you're not responsible for it. Right? You're not responsible. Because they won't even know who put it up. And this way, every fool has his audience. Every fool gets his audience. You might have nothing to say that's good for the world. Nothing to say that's even worth listening to. But you can put it up on the internet, and I can guarantee you that there will at least be 1,000 other fools who are willing to listen. It's impersonal. And God is eminently personal. This is one of the most fundamental points of the Vedas, of the Bhagavad Gita, that God is ultimately a person. He's someone we can relate to, someone who we can interact with. Sometimes he answers our prayers, and sometimes he doesn't. That's the mark of a person. Right? Only a machine always does what you want it to. You go to a photocopy machine, it'll always make the photocopy. If I ask a person to make the photocopy, maybe he'll do it, maybe he won't. Maybe he'll say, go do it yourself. If you want that kind of dependability, always your prayers are to be answered, then you cannot have a person. Because people are not like that. Krishna has likes, he has dislikes. There are things he likes to do, things he doesn't like to do. He makes this very clear in Bhagavad Gita. Things that he likes, things he doesn't like. He likes to steal butter. He doesn't like to steal oil. What does he prefer? He has feelings, he has emotions, he has relationships. No strings attached. This is the point of knowledge without responsibility we make. God is fundamentally about moral responsibility. You're accountable for everything that's there. With God, accountability is the first thing. The internet is all about information, and God is fundamentally about transformation. What Krishna is concerned with is not what you know, but who you are, who you can become. Now, look at the same list, and think about it in terms of relationships. If we're searching for relationships in this world, meaningful relationships, right, and this is what it seems people are looking for, from the searches and the hits you see on Google. What kind of relationship are you going to get from Google? Not relationship with Google. I mean relationship through Google. The relationships you build through the internet, what are they going to be like? They're going to be ephemeral, in flux, public, impersonal, no commitment, no strings attached. Relationships with God, what are they going to be? Relationships that have God in the center of them, they're going to be eternal. They're going to be stable. They're going to be private. They're going to be personal. And they're going to involve moral responsibility. So this is our choice. This is the choice we have. We can make
a God-free environment. We can make a 100% sterilized, technology-full environment. This is what we're setting ourselves up for. Loneliness, desolation. Or we can put God into the picture. Because ultimately, He has to be the center of the picture. Right? We all come into this world. We all come into this world thinking ourselves the kings of all we serve. Every person thinks of themselves as a king, a prince or a princess. Every child, he grows up, he plays in a sandbox, and he's the king of that sandbox. Every girl, she has her dollhouse and her doll, and she's the princess of her palace. This is why we like fairy tales so much. The story of Cinderella and Snow White, and the princess who kissed the frog, and all these things, right? Each one of us is hoping, I'm the prince. One day my princess will arrive. I'll kiss her and she'll wake up. Every girl in this world is waiting for her knight in shiny white armor to show up on a white horse and take her away. When will that man of my dreams arrive? We're all looking for our kingdom. And so all these fairy tales, this happens, right? And the prince and the princess, the king and the queen, they ride off into the sunset. The story is always nice, always beautiful, as they ride off into the sunset. The real question that no fairy tale ever asks, is what happens after they ride off into the sunset. Right? That's when all the issues begin. That's when all the problems begin. Right? That never happens. They become king, they become queen, they ride off into the sunset, then what happens? Right? We come into this world looking to be the king or the queen of our palace. And we become disappointed. Because the problem is, I'm thinking that I'm the lord of what I survey. This is my sphere, my space. But he's also thinking the same thing. And you're also thinking the same thing. And of course, we're all sharing the same space. And so what happens? Conflict. War. Argument. Dissension. Husbands and wives, they fight like anything. Parents and children, they fight like anything. Brothers and brothers, they fight like anything. Colleagues at work fight like anything. Bosses and employees, they fight like anything. Right? Because everyone's the king of their world. And there's only one world to share. If we're looking for true relationships, we have to take ourselves out of the center and put God into the center. That's the only way it's going to work. Why? Because no matter how big of a circle we want to create, some person says, look, I'm not a selfish person. I'm not a selfish person. I care about my family. So they're not self-centered. The circle is a little bit bigger. It's me and my family. And you say, well, that's still selfish. It's you and your family, right? People who are blood related to you. So they say, okay, not the family. I care about my community. Me, my family, and my community. And our circle becomes bigger. Someone might even care not just for their community, but their nation. Me and my nation, my country, and the circle becomes even bigger. What to speak of nation, they might even care for the whole world. I'm a servant of humanity, and the circle becomes even bigger. No matter how big you make that circle, who's at the middle of it? Who's at the center still? Me. Everyone's defined according to how they're connected to me. And that mentality is never going to work. Because as long as there's enough to go around, as long as there's enough for you and me, oh, you can be part of my circle, why not? Come, sit next to me. There's enough prasad for everyone to eat. I've got two plates here, you can have one. But when there's not enough to go around,
when there's only one place, then who's going to get it? The person at the center of the circle, me. Right? So the system works, this idea of I'm going to include everyone in my love, right? It works as long as things are nice, there's enough to go around. And as soon as there's not enough to go around, there's some tension, the system breaks down. Because you're still at the center of all those circles. The only way we can have real relationships, selfless relationships, is when we remove ourselves from that center and put God at the center. When we water the roots of the tree and all the leaves are watered, that becomes true selflessness. Because God is that one circle who can truly include everyone, who can bring everyone together, who can connect everyone to Him. And this is what Krishna is asking of us in Bhagavad Gita. He says, Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja. Right? He says, put me at the center of that circle. Why? You think, Mam Ekam, this is exclusive? No, it's not exclusive. Because He includes everything within it. Right? He says, Yad Yad Vibhuti Mat Satvam Srimad Urjitam Evava Satta Deva Vavachatvam Mama Devyosha Sambhava. He says, anything that there is in this world, all beautiful and glorious things in this world are all a part of my own splendor. They're all a part of my own glory. So this is the message for today. Let's not be carried away by the lure of the information age, by the lure of technology. What I'm trying to express, this is not an old-fashioned message, right? What we're not saying, go back to the Stone Age. Throw away your computers. Don't look at the internet. No! Use it for what it is. Right? What is the internet? It's a tool. It's a tool. Just like a hammer and a chisel, that's all. Right? No one goes around worshipping a hammer. No one says, this is it. I can have a relationship with my hammer. I can get to know everyone through the hammer. No. It's just a tool. It all depends on what you do with it. Keep it as a tool in your life. And find true relationships. Find real places to connect with people. Find real places to connect with God. That's the way to truly stay in touch. To truly stay connected, wired all the time. Wired to Krishna. Thank you very much for your attention. I'll conclude at that point. If there's any questions, comments, ideas from the audience, I'll be happy to take them. Yes, please. Now, please. Oh, is there a mic?
Because Hindu worship, actually God is God.
Okay, that's a very good question.